Mark Revisited, number 43. And our text is Mark 15, 1-32. And our theme, suffered under Pontius Pilate. Chapter 15 of Mark. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. So they bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "You have said so," Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things, so again Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of." But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. Now it was the custom at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the rebels who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing it was out of self-interest that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to get Pilate to release Barabbas instead. "What shall I do then with the one you call king of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shouted. "Why, what crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the Praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spat on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. It was 9 a.m. when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified 2 rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross, save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those who crucified with him also heaped insults on him. This is the word of the Lord. Now, chapter 14 was all about the abandonment of the Lord Jesus by his friends. Chapter 15 continues the same theme of abandonment, but now abandoned by his enemies. Even more precision might suggest abandonment by church and state, and that would speak to the reality of things for many a faithful servant of God in every age. And then, of course, finally, the awesome abandonment by the Father as the Son bears the sins of the world. What is one to make of Mark's account of the so-called trial at night before the Great Council, or indeed of Jesus before Pilate? Both seem farcical. I read somewhere that if you wanted a transcript of either occasion, you'd be disappointed. In both cases, Mark is so very brief. As though the foundation facts were so well known by his Christian readers. And that wouldn't be surprising, for the early preachers will have gone over the ground of this most important story again and again, many, many times. Or is it, as I am persuaded, that Mark is making a supremely serious point by interpreting these events, in short, not just summoning up the situation, but preaching a message. Knowing Mark as we now do, that will be no surprise. So let me put it like this. Mark's central concern in these chapters, as ever, is with Jesus as King Messiah. Think of that moment of truth and decision in the council, for example, 1462, when Jesus declared, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One, coming on the clouds of heaven." Or again, run through 15:1-32, as I've just read it, and notice the 6 references to the King of the Jews. In the encounter with Pilate, even the most casual reader can hardly miss the big issue as they listen to the questions. Verse 2, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Verse 9, "Do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews?" Verse 12, "What then shall I do with the one you call the King of the Jews?" And then further references to the King of Jews in verses 18, 25, and 32, which I won't now read again. So yes, according to the Lord himself and according to Mark, and this I think is the point he is wanting to make, Jesus is king in this situation. There's no secret about it. There's no doubt. But the question is, what kind of a king is he? That question has been at the heart of Mark's message from the very start of his record. All along, we're hearing this. He's not like any ruler you've ever known or heard of. And what a point this is to make to his readers in Rome. Christians living there would know just how odd the rule of Jesus was and how different from anything people experienced there. These first and second generation believers have come to recognize that their Lord and King ruled from the cross by his death. That's what Mark has recorded and taught them. That's what the apostles taught them too. Whereas Romans ruled by putting to death their numerous enemies. If they ruled by the cross, it was literally by using thousands of them to crucify people. Indeed, when Titus entered Jerusalem to destroy the city and burn the temple, so many thousands of Jews were crucified that the supply of wood ran out. King Jesus then ruled and exercised his authority by service and taught his future apostles to do likewise. This has had an astounding effect, of course, through Christian civilization. Theory and practice may not always coincide, but it's a striking concept that the one who presides over government in Britain is the first minister, the first servant. How long that can survive a secular society, who can tell? Meanwhile, non-Christian states and rulers, whether secular or religious, will be prepared to enforce their authority through the 3 S's: sword, shotgun, and suicide bomber. Nero himself was a monster, we know that, but there have been worse monsters since, and there will be more in the future. Some things never change. It is Christian wisdom to face modern realities and warn people, including our leaders, not to be naive and complacent. We now come to the really interesting question and answer. Question: how does Mark reassure his readers, living in tough times, that the Jesus who was crucified for them is truly God's King for them? Answer: he appeals to the authority of Scripture, the authority of the biblical prophets, and he does this in a memorable and unmistakable way. That is, he tells his story of the Passion in terms recognizable as coming straight from the Old Testament, for example, from Isaiah 53. And like so often in reading the Scriptures, when you first see it, you're surprised that you've not seen it before. In John Stott's Cross of Christ, he refers to Isaiah 53 many times, especially in pages 145-147. He also provides some memorable quotations from commentators on Isaiah 53. The first is Jeremias on the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, quote, "No other passage from the Old Testament was as important to the church as Isaiah 53. A second quotation comes from J.S. Whale on the same chapter, the same servant song. Quote, "The song makes 12 distinct and explicit statements that the servant suffers the penalty of other men's sins, not only vicarious suffering, But penal substitution is the plain meaning of the 4th, 5th, and 6th verses." Unquote. Clearly Mark readily uses this wonderful prophecy, and equally clearly his readers would understand the references he makes. This was familiar territory for yesterday's converts to Christianity, and should be the same today for young converts to Christianity. Here then are 7 examples from Mark's text, in no particular order, that quote Isaiah 53. As I am no Hebrew expert, I depend for help here on Alec Mateer's magnum opus, The Prophecy of Isaiah, IVP 1993. So 7 examples from the text we've read that actually are quotations from Isaiah 53, or references. 1, the silence of Jesus. 2, the physical appearance of Jesus. 3, the mockery of Jesus. 4, the powerlessness of Jesus. 5, the innocence of the Lord. 6, the death of Jesus. And 7th, the triumph of Christ. 1, the silence of Jesus, recorded in Mark 14, 60 and 61, and in our reading today, chapter 15, verses 4 and 5. This is foretold in Isaiah 53, 7. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. 2, the physical appearance of Jesus. Here the gospel writers are famously restrained. Verse 15 of Mark, Jesus is flogged, a horrific punishment. Verse 24, he is crucified, the ultimate in barbaric cruelty. But it's all put in the most restrained way. This comes, of course, from Isaiah 52:14, part of the 7th passage. I quote, "Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured, his form marred beyond human likeness." Unquote. Here is Alec Mateer's comment. The thought is not that the servant suffered more than any other individual, but that he experienced disfigurement, so that those who saw him stepped back in horror, not only saying, "Is this the servant?" but "Is this human?" Unquote. In the light of this, can we not imagine his mother and other brave women looking on, saying, "I can't bear to look." 3, the mockery. Here we have Mark 15, verse 16 following. Mateer tells us that the word despised in chapter 53 of Isaiah verse 3 relates to the verb in Isaiah 37:22 and has the sense of belittling, scorning, and ridiculing. Well, even disciplined soldiers today still behave like this in war conditions, and this exactly pictures the mockery in Mark 15 which we have read. More widely today, it's commonplace for the new atheist to belittle, scorn, ridicule, and mock Christianity. These things don't change, neither does the folly of mankind. 4, the powerlessness of Jesus. This was a voluntary powerlessness in one who had 12 legions of angels at his disposal, had he wished to use them. So, in Isaiah 53:7, he was led as a sheep to the slaughter, as he opened not his mouth. In the light of this powerlessness, this defenselessness, perhaps 53:1 is equally telling. Quote, "Who has believed our message? To whom has the arm or power of the Lord been revealed?" As Mateer says, the answer to the question is no one. Who could see power in a crucified man? Who would see the arm of God in that helpless figure? "Come down," they say, "and then we'll believe you." Whereas, of course, it's because he did not come down that we believe in him, love him, and are saved from hell by him. Then 5, the innocence of Jesus. This is Mark 15, verse 10 and verse 14, which I've just read. Pilate has long since announced to the world the Lord's innocence. Perhaps Isaiah's witness to God's righteous servant, verse 11b, is one of his preeminent messages, matched only by his willingness to die the righteous for the unrighteous to bring us to God. So he, the righteous one, he was pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. Verse 5. Next, number 6, the death of Jesus. From all of Isaiah 53, I will choose just verse 9a. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. Here, Motyer wrestles with the complexities of the Hebrew text and writes, quote, like the other enigmas in the song, this too is written, so that when the turn of events provides the explanation, we shall know for certain that we stand in the presence of the servant of the Lord. Meanwhile, the picture of Jesus dying in the company of a couple of criminals, yet hustled after death into an unused tomb of a wealthy man, remains unforgettable. Who could invent such a scene? Finally, 7, the triumph of Jesus. The great final verses of Isaiah 53, discussed at length by Motyer, are summarized by him as follows, quote, the Lord gives his servant all those whom he has redeemed, in token that in the sight of God the work of redemption has been successfully completed. Total supremacy is, however, his by right of conquest. He's not given the strong as those captured by some other power and then placed under his charge. He takes them by his own superior power and disposes of them according to his own pleasure. So we can sum up by saying that Isaiah 53 begins with the servant's vilification and ends with his victory. Note too how very illuminating this is also in Psalm 22, the opening cry of which is the sole word from the cross recorded by Mark. For Psalm 2 also begins with the psalmist's dereliction and ends with his dominion. But a dominion that never was true of any Old Testament ruler. A dominion over all the nations of the world and all the generations of mankind. Simon Peter was not the only person to be baffled by a king who was overpowered by his enemies and died as a disgraced outsider. Living under the powers that be in first century Rome, Christians would need this kind of regular reassurance as they witness to their friends of Christ and him crucified. How could your pagan neighbors recognize this Jesus as a king, leave alone a son of God? However, as a matter of record, they did, beginning with a heathen soldier responsible for the execution of Jesus. Since then, again as a matter of record, millions have confessed Jesus as Lord through the proclamation of Christ and him crucified. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. So it is, so it has been, and so it will be till Christ returns.